No, Willie said. Not yet. And it was then they saw the dog. It moved as an indefinite black shape through the fog until its figure emerged before them. There were spots of white on its chest and brown around its toes, but the rest of it was black. It had short, bristly hair and seemed to be of no specific breed, a generic dog with pieces of many dogs inside it. It was coming toward them, slowly but directly, not even stopping to smell a hydrant or a pole, not wandering, but walking. This dog was going somewhere. This dog had a destination. My father.
What's this? Edward said.
Willie smiled.
A dog, Willie said. Comes to check everybody out sooner or later. Usually sooner. He's a kind of gatekeeper, if you know what I mean.
No, my father said. I don't know what you mean.
You will, Willie said. You will. Call him, he said.
Call? What's his name?
No name. He never belonged to anybody, so he never got a name. Just call him Dog.
Dog?
That's right. Dog.
So my father kneeled and clapped his hands and tried to look friendly.
Here, dog. Come here, buddy.
Here, boy. Come on.
And Dog, who had been walking a long, straight line, froze and stared at my father for a long time. A long time for a dog, anyway. Half a minute. The hair on his back stood ridged. His eyes locked on my father's eyes. He opened his mouth and showed him his teeth and the ferocious pinkness of his gums. He was about 10 feet away and growling wildly.
Maybe I should get out of his way, he said. I don't think he's taken to me so well.
Stick out your hand, Willie said.
My father said, what? Dog's growl came on stronger then.
Stick out your hand and let him smell it.
Willie, I don't think...
Stick out your hand, he said.
Slowly, my father stuck out his hand. Dog came to it with his slow steps, his low snarl, his jaws set to snap. But as the tip of his nose rubbed against my father's knuckles, he whined. And Dog licked my father's whole hand. Dog's tail wagged, my father's heart beating. Willie looked on in sadness and defeat, as if he had been betrayed.
Does this mean I can go?
My father asked, standing while the dog rubbed against his legs.
Not yet, Willie said, grabbing my father again,
the grip of his hand pinching deep into the muscle.
You'll want a cup of coffee before you go.
The Good Food Cafe was one big room lined with green vinyl booths and gold-speckled formica tables. There were paper placements on the tables and thin silver spoons and forks encrusted with dried food. There was a dimness inside, a thick grayness. And though almost every table was occupied, there seemed to be no real life here. None of the anxious expectancy of a hunger about to be sated. But when Willie and my father came in, they all looked up and smiled, as though their meal had just arrived. Willie and my father sat at a table and, without even asking, were brought 2 cups of coffee by a silent waitress. Deep, black, steaming pools. Willie stared into his cup and shook his head.
You think you've got it made? Don't you, son?
Willie smiled as he brought the coffee to his lips.
Think you're a real big fish. But you're not the first we've seen. Look at Jimmy Edwards over there, big football star, good student. He wanted to be a businessman in the city, make his fortune, whatnot. Never made it out of here, though. Didn't have the intestinal fortitude, you know.
He leaned over and whispered,
"That dog got his left index finger."
My father looked and saw it was true. Jimmy moved his hand slowly off the table and stuck it in his pocket and turned away. My father looked at the others who were looking at him and saw that it was the same with everybody. Nobody could claim all their fingers, and some could only boast a few. My father looked at Willie, about to ask him why, but it was as if Willie could read his mind.
"The number of times they tried to go," he said, "either out of here or back to where they came from. That dog," he said, looking at his own hand, "don't play games."
Then slowly, as if drawn there by a sound only they could hear, the people sitting at the tables around him stood and walked to the edge of his booth, where they looked at him and smiled. Some of their names he remembered from his childhood in Ashland: Cedric Folks, Sally Dumas, Ben Lightfoot. But they were different now. He could almost see through them, seemed like. But then something happened, and he couldn't, as if they were coming in and out of focus. He looked beyond them to the door of the cafe where Dog sat. Dog sat there staring in, unmoving, and my father rubbed his hands together, wondering what he was waiting on, and if he had missed his chance to get by Dog before, and the next time maybe he wouldn't be so lucky. A woman named Rosemary Wilcox stood by the booth. She had fallen in love with a man from the city and tried to run off with him, but only he had made it out. Her eyes were dark and sunken into what was once a pretty face. She remembered my father from when he was little and told him how nice it was to see him again, so big and tall and handsome. The crowd around the booth grew larger and moved in closer, and my father found he couldn't move. There was no space for it. Crowding up close beside him at the edge of the booth was a man older even than Willie. He was like petrified life. His skin had dried and grown tight around his bones, and his veins were blue and as cold-looking as a frozen river.
I wouldn't trust that dog, the man said slowly. I just wouldn't take the chance, son. He didn't get you before, but you never know about the next time. It's unpredictable. So sit tight, he said, and tell us all about the world you want to go to and the things you want to find there.
And the old man closed his eyes, and so did Willie, and so did they all. All of them wanting to hear about the bright world my father knew was waiting for him just around the bend on the other side of this dark place. And so he told them. And when he finished, they all thanked him and smiled. And the old man said,
"That was nice."
"Can we do it again tomorrow?" someone said.
"Let's do it again tomorrow," another whispered.
"It's good to have you," a man said to my father. "Good to have you here."
"I know a real nice girl," Rosemary said. "Pretty, too. Looks like me a little bit. I'd be happy to get you two together, if you know what I mean."
"I'm sorry," my father said, looking from one to the other. "There's been a misunderstanding. I'm not here to stay."
"I reckon there has been a misunderstanding," Ben Lightfoot said, looking at my father with a deep loathing.
"But we can't let you go," Rosemary said in a soft voice.
"I have to go," my father said, trying to stand. But he couldn't. They crowded round him so.
"At least stay for a little while," Willie said. "A few days, at least."
"Get to know us," Rosemary said, brushing her hair from her eyes with her terrible hand. "You'll forget about the rest."
But suddenly there came a rustling sound from the back of the circle of men and women around him, and then a scream and a barking growl, and like a miracle, the people moved away. It was Dog. He growled a vicious growl and showed them his terrible teeth, and they all backed away from the drooling monster, clutching their hands close to their chests. My father took his chance and ran through the opening, and he didn't look back. He ran through the darkness until it became light again, and the world turned green and wonderful. The asphalt gave way to gravel, the gravel to dirt, and the beauty of a magic world seemed not too far away. When the road ended, he stopped and breathed, and found that Dog was right behind him, and when he reached my father, he rubbed his warm body against his legs. There was no sound now save the wind through the trees and their feet along a barely beaten trail. And then all at once the woods opened up, and before them was a lake, a huge green lake bending off into the distance as far as he could see. And at the edge of the lake was a small wooden dock bobbing in the waves the wind made. They made their way down to it. And once there, Dog collapsed, as if emptied of all strength. My father looked around him, proud somehow, and he watched the sun set behind the stand of trees, and he breathed in the air, and he dug his fingers into the loose skin around Dog's warm neck, rubbing the muscles there with a thorough gentleness, as though he were rubbing the muscles of his own heart. And Dog made his dog-happy sounds. And the sun set. And the moon rose, and the water in the lake began to gently ripple. And in the white light of the moon, then he saw the girl, her head breaking the surface a good ways out, the water flowing through her hair and back into the lake, and she was smiling. She was smiling, and my father was too. And then she waved at my father, and he waved back. Hello, he said, waving to her. Goodbye. Entering a New World. The story of my father's first day in the world he would come to live in is best told perhaps by a man who worked with him, Jasper Buddy Barron. Buddy was vice president of Bloom Incorporated, taking over the helm when my father retired. Buddy was a natty dresser. He wore a power yellow tie, an executive's dark blue pinstripe suit, black shoes, and those tight, thin, almost transparent socks in the same blue hue of his suit that climbed to an undetermined length up his calves. He had a silk handkerchief peering like a pet mouse over the edge of the false pocket on the heart side of his suit. And he was the first and only man I've ever met who actually had graying temples, just like they say in books. The rest of his hair was dark and full and healthy, and his part was one long straight line of pinkish scalp, a country road across his head. When he told this story, he'd like to lean back in his chair and smile. The year was 19-something or other, he'd begin, longer ago than any of us want to remember. Edward had just left home, 17 years old. For the first time in his life, he was on his own. But was he worried? No, he wasn't worried. His mother had given him a few dollars to live on, 10, maybe 12, more money at any rate than he had ever had in his life. And he had his dreams. Dreams are what keep a man going, William. And already your father was a dreaming empire. But looking at him on the day he left that town he was born in, you would have seen little more than a young, handsome boy with nothing but the clothes on his back and the holes in his shoes. You might not have actually seen the holes in his shoes, but they were there, William. The holes were there. Well, that first day he walked 30 miles. That night he slept under the stars on a bed of pine straw. And here, on this night, is where fate's hand first tugged on your father's belt loops. For as he slept, he was come upon by two men of the woods, who beat him within an inch of his life and took from him every last dollar he had. He barely survived. And yet, 30 years later, when he first told me this story,
and this to me is vintage Edward Bloom. He said that if he ever met with those men again, the two thugs who beat him within an inch of his life and took his last dollar, he would thank them. Thank them, for, in a way, they determined the course of the rest of his life. Well, at the time, of course, dying in the dark of that strange wood, he was far from grateful. But by morning, he was well rested, and though bleeding still from various parts of his body, he began walking, no longer knowing or caring where he was going, but just walking, forward, onward, ready for whatever life and fate chose to hurl at him next. When he saw an old country store and an old man out in front of it, rocking back and forth in his chair, back and forth, forth and back, who presently began to stare with alarm at the bloody figure approaching. He called for his wife, and she called for her daughter, and within half a minute they had a pot of hot water, a washcloth, and a bunch of bandages made from a sheet they had just torn into strips, and stood ready as Edward hobbled to meet them. They were ready to save this stranger's life, more than ready. They were determined. But, of course, he wouldn't let them. He could not let them save his life. No man of your father's integrity, and they are few, William, they are precious few and far between, would accept such charity, even when it was a matter of life or death. For how could he live with himself, if indeed he did live at all, knowing that his life was so inextricably bound to others, knowing that he was not his own man? So, still bleeding, and with one of his legs broken in two places, Edward found a broom and swept the store clean. Then he found a mop and a pail, for in his haste to do the right thing, he had completely forgotten his open, profusely bleeding wounds, and didn't realize until he had finished sweeping that he had left a trail of his own blood throughout the entire store. So he mopped. He scoured. He got on his knees with a rag and scrubbed as the old man, the wife, and the child watched him. They were in awe. They were all struck. They were watching a man trying to remove his own bloodstains from a pine wood floor. It was impossible. Impossible! Yet he tried. That's the thing, William. He tried. Tried until he could try no more. Until he fell on his face flat out, still clutching the rag. Dead. Or so they thought. They thought he had died. They rushed to his body. There was some life in him yet. And in a scene, as your father described it, that has always reminded me somehow of Michelangelo's Pietà. The mother, a strong woman, lifted him up and held him in her arms, in her lap, this young man, this dying man, praying for his life. It seemed hopeless. But as the others anxiously crowded around him, he opened his eyes and said what might have been his last words, said to the old man whose store Edward had immediately realized was empty of customers, said in what might have been his last breath, "Advertise." Buddy would let the word ring through the room. And the rest, as they say, is history. Your father recovered. Soon as he was strong again, he plowed the fields, weeded the gardens, helped around the store. He roamed about the countryside, posting little notices, advertising for Ben Jimson's country store. It was his idea to call it a country store, by the way. He thought it sounded more friendly, more appealing than just store, and he was right. It was also at this time your father invented the slogan, "Buy one, get one free." Five little words, William, but they turned Ben Jimson into a rich man. He stayed with the Jimsons for almost a year, earning his first little nest egg. The world, like a splendid flower, opened up for him. "And as you can see," he would say, gesturing to the gold and leather extravagances of his own office, and with a minor nod in my direction as though I, too, were nothing but a product of my father's legendary industriousness, "for a boy from Ashland, Alabama, he's done rather well." Part 2. The Old Lady and the Eye. After leaving the Jimsons,
My father wandered south through the countryside, going from town to town, having many adventures, and meeting a number of interesting and